Today is Wednesday, February 25th, 2026, and you're listening to the World Socialist website. Union Bureaucracy Sabotages the Kaiser Permanente Strike, by Tom Hall. On Monday afternoon, the United Nurses Association of California, Union of Healthcare Professionals, abruptly shut down the month-long strike by 31,000 healthcare workers at Kaiser Permanente in California and Hawaii. There was no semblance of democratic discussion, no new contract, and not even a tentative agreement. The UNAC-UHCP bureaucracy simply cited unexplained, significant movement at the bargaining table and ordered workers back to work. Once again, a critical struggle of the working class has been sold out by the trade union bureaucracy. Kaiser nurses and other healthcare workers were fighting against stagnant wages, chronically understaffed facilities, and staffing ratios too low to provide adequate patient care. Kaiser Permanente, though formally designated a nonprofit, is a healthcare giant that epitomizes the private, profit-driven character of American medicine. The corporation reported $9.3 billion in net income, while CEO Greg Adams received $13 million in compensation. Kaiser has recently settled with the Department of Justice for $556 million for Medicare fraud. Kaiser also maintains extensive investments in contractors that profit from ICE detention. It recently entered into an agreement with Walter Reed National Military Medical Center to train military doctors in preparation for mass casualty scenarios in future wars. The shutdown of the strike was a deliberate act of sabotage, not only against Kaiser healthcare workers, but against a broader movement emerging in the country. The strike was shut down the same day that 500 Kaiser operating engineers were to have joined the strike. UNAC-UHCP ended the strike right when it was on the verge of gaining over 100,000 reinforcement from workers across California. 65,000 teachers and classified staff in the Los Angeles Unified School District have authorized strikes in the face of sweeping budget cuts. 40,000 graduate and academic workers in the University of California system, members of the United Auto Workers, have voted to strike. A unified movement would have laid the basis for a powerful strike wave across the West Coast, encouraging similar action throughout the country. The bureaucracy could not allow this because it would threaten their financial and social interest. Other similar betrayals have taken place over the last several days. Over the weekend, union officials in New York City shut down the final holdouts of a six-week strike by nurses at New York Presbyterian, where nurses rejected an earlier deal the union put to a vote, in violation of its own bylaws. In California, union officials ended a four-day strike by 6,000 San Francisco teachers earlier this month. The city, awash in cash from the artificial intelligence boom, is pleading poverty for public schools. Layoffs were announced almost immediately after the strike ended, with the district citing declining enrollment. These betrayals have been accompanied by the open intervention of Democratic Party politicians. In San Francisco, multi-millionaire Mayor Daniel Lurie and former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, who amassed immense wealth during her decades in Washington, played central roles in brokering the teachers' deal. In New York City, Democratic Socialist Mayor Zoran Mamdani and Julie Hsu, former U.S. Labor Secretary and now Deputy Mayor for Economic Justice, worked behind the scenes to work out a settlement as police arrested protesting nurses. Similar patterns are evident elsewhere. The United Steelworkers pushed through a sellout agreement covering 30,000 refinery workers setting the stage for an isolated strike at BP Whiting in Indiana, where management is demanding deeper concessions. As with the previous contract reached at the start of the Ukraine war, this was a war contract. Its purpose is to keep fuel flowing as the U.S. military wages war against Iran. Union officials in Minneapolis and across the country have directly opposed strike action against ICE raids. Teachers' unions have instructed members not to encourage or participate in student walkouts protesting deportations. The UAW warns that the right to strike is at risk under the Trump administration, yet has proposed no action to defend it. This conduct flows from the fundamental social and economic interest of the bureaucracy, not from a merely conservative outlook. Over the past four decades, even as strike activity was driven to historic lows, spending on union officials expanded dramatically. U.S. unions spend hundreds of millions of dollars drawn from workers' dues and invested in the stock market on six-figure salaries, luxury travel, and a host of other privileges. Their hostility to the working class is bound up with entrenched anti-communism, nationalism, and deep connections to corporate politicians. Historically, the Democratic Party has been their principal vehicle. Increasingly, however, sections of the bureaucracy have aligned themselves with Trump, drawn by their support for America First policies and economic nationalism. At Kaiser, UNAC-UHCP participates in the Labor Management Partnership, funded by management with millions of dollars annually. The partnership was explicitly established in 1997 to prevent strikes and foster a, quote, culture of collaboration, according to the agreement's own language. During the recent strike, Kaiser implicitly threatened this framework in a lawsuit, effectively threatening the union bureaucrats with a cutoff of funding if they fail to end the strike. A clear rule has emerged. The more powerful the objective position of workers, and the more a broader movement begins to develop, the more openly the union bureaucracy intervenes to sabotage it. No amount of pressure can alter the social interest of this layer, any more than pressure can induce corporate management to abandon the capitalist profit motive. Workers therefore must organize themselves to confront and override this sabotage. The task is not the reform of the apparatus, but its removal from control over the struggle and the restoration of power to the shop floor. This is a necessary step toward establishing the political independence and freedom of initiative of the working class. Linking immediate contract struggles with the fight against fascism, war, and social inequality. The International Workers' Alliance of Rank-and-File Committees, the IWARFC, calls on workers to form rank-and-file committees, connected across workplaces and industries, to discuss strategy and prepare collective action, regardless of the permission of union officials. Such organizations must be completely independent of corporate politics, including the Democratic Party, whose leaders fear an independent movement of the working class more than they oppose Trump. A network of rank-and-file committees is indispensable to the preparation of a general strike, which emerges as the logical and necessary outcome of the developing opposition. The IWARFC fights to build new forms of struggle, corresponding to the conditions of the class struggle in the 21st century. Workers who agree with this perspective and wish to take up this fight should make contact and begin the process of organizing rank-and-file committees today. Mass protest in Detroit area against plans for ICE detention and operation centers by our reporters. Hundreds of workers, students, and middle-class residents in Detroit suburbs protested Monday evening against the Trump administration's plans to expand immigration and customs enforcement, or ICE, operations across the metro area. The demonstrations in Romulus and Southfield are part of a growing wave of protest, student walkouts, and public meetings, erupting nationwide following the violent immigration raids and killings carried out by federal agents in Minneapolis last month. In Romulus, an estimated 700 to 800 people gathered outside City Hall to oppose plans by the Department of Homeland Security, or DHS, to convert a 250,000 square foot warehouse into a 500-bed ICE detention center. The proposed facility is located near the Detroit Metropolitan Airport, a placement widely understood to facilitate rapid and secretive deportation flights. If completed, the Romulus Center would be one of 23 new mega warehouse detention centers DHS plans to open across the country as part of a massive expansion of federal immigration enforcement infrastructure. At the same time, 200 to 300 people packed a Southfield City Council meeting to protest the leasing of office space to ICE agents at the One Town Square building. City officials acknowledged last week that the U.S. General Service Administration had secured the space, claiming it would be used only to support ICE, quote, administrative and legal services. Few in attendance found this reassurance credible. Protesters at both locations carried signs denouncing ICE concentration camps, fascism, and Nazism, and defending the rights of immigrant workers and youth. Many attempted to enter city council chambers en masse, but Democratic Party officials relied on local police to limit access. In Romulus, chants of "Let us in" echoed outside the meeting as officers blocked entry. Students played a prominent role in the demonstrations. A student from the Cesar Chavez Academy in Detroit explained why young people had walked out of school. Quote, "Basically, our whole school walked out because we're trying to make a change. Everything that ICE is doing is not right. People are here to live their life in a good way. Everyone's seeing what the cartel is doing in Mexico, and they wonder why people are trying to leave for a safe space." Referring to widely circulated social media videos of the Quakertown, Pennsylvania police chief placing a young girl protesting ICE in a chokehold, she said, "That's not right. The students were speaking for people who can't speak for themselves." Her mother, standing beside her, defended the walkout. "They're exercising their First Amendment freedom of speech, and they're using their voice and walking out of school for a reason. When my daughter did it, I was proud of her." End quote. Allison Bader, speaking on behalf of an immigrant rights organization, stressed the urgency of sustained public action. Quote, "It's exceptionally important to be in the streets as much as humanly possible to put pressure onto the Trump administration. We have families being absolutely torn apart, children held in concentration camps. My organization has been into the Baldwin camp 7 times alone, helping people," she said, referring to the privately run North Lake ICE Detention Center in Baldwin, Michigan, which she called the, quote, "second largest concentration camp in the United States right now," end quote. Bader warned that locating the Romulus Center near the airport would make it, quote, "convenient to disappear human beings and continuing all the horrible stuff we know is true. This is no longer a Trump thing, and it's not just a Democrat or Republican. This is a human rights problem, and we have to stand up for each other," end quote. Pointing to the immense wealth concentrated in the hands of corporate elites, she added, "The billionaires have to go. They need to be taxed at an insane amount because nobody needs $1 billion. They buy off both sides, the Democrats and Republicans. That's why they don't want the Epstein files to be released, because the entire system will collapse because it's all of them." End quote. The Socialist Equality Party, the SEP, intervened in both demonstrations and city council meetings to argue that the defense of immigrant workers requires the independent mobilization of the working class. SCP member Jerry White, who recently returned from Minneapolis, addressed protesters in Romulus about the lessons of the mass movement that erupted there. He pointed to the January 23rd march of more than 50,000 people in Minneapolis, held despite sub-zero temperatures, as a powerful expression of popular opposition. However, he warned that the following day the Trump administration responded with, quote, the cold-blooded murder of ICU nurse Alex Pretty. What unfolded in Minneapolis over the last month, he said, was, quote, only a dry run for repression, the deportation of children, and the murder of anti-ICE protesters in Michigan and other states. White emphasized that while chants against ICE expressed genuine anger, they were not sufficient to halt the repression. Quote, we have to mobilize the working class, the auto workers, the Amazon workers, the truck drivers, the airline workers, in the preparation for a general strike to demand the abolition of ICE, the ending of the witch hunting of immigrants, and the holding responsible those who violate constitutional rights from the local police to the Trump administration. End quote. He issued two warnings. First, about the role of the trade union bureaucracy, which had blocked workers in Minneapolis from striking in solidarity with protesters. And second, about the Democratic Party. In Minnesota, Democratic Governor Tim Walz had reached an agreement with the Trump administration to deploy state troopers and Minneapolis police to arrest anti-ICE protesters and hand detained immigrants over to federal agents. This arrangement, White explained, allowed Trump to withdraw some federal agents from Minneapolis and redeploy them to other states, including Michigan. A new stage of resistance was required, he said, involving the formation of rank-and-file committees in every factory, workplace, school, and neighborhood, to organize opposition independently of both corporate-controlled parties. Several Democratic politicians appeared at the Romulus protest, including Lieutenant Governor Garland Gilchrist and State Legislator Darren Camilleri and Dylan Wegela. They presented themselves as opponents of Trump while encouraging attendees to channel their anger into the upcoming midterm elections. The Romulus City Council adopted a non-binding resolution declaring its opposition to the detention center, primarily citing concerns about local resources, potential strain on the police department, and the possibility that the facility would, quote, depress property values and deter business investment, end quote. One council member suggested I should instead utilize one of Michigan's empty prisons. Another commented on the increased cost of policing mass demonstrations. During public comment, one speaker noted that Romulus High School students had walked out the day after news of the detention center became public and criticized Democratic Mayor Robert McRae for initially dismissing reports as unsubstantiated. Another worker asked bluntly, when did America become Nazi Germany, where you have to show your papers? At the Southfield City Council meeting, hundreds of residents packed the chamber. The council unanimously approved a carefully worded resolution affirming, quote, local control, community safety, and the protection of civil rights, while pointedly declaring that the city cannot ignore federal law, end quote. As tensions rose, Council President Lloyd Hicks read rules banning, quote, personal or impertinent attacks, and used them to silence 15-year-old Charles O'Neill. I'm here because too many of you people won't speak up for yourselves, O'Neill began, denouncing ICE moving into Southfield, an election denier counting your ballots. 2026 is being taken away from us. He quoted the anti-Nazi poem, First They Came for the Socialist, to link the attack on immigrants to a broader authoritarian trajectory. City Clerk Gabby Grossbart demanded police remove him, and officers escorted the teenager out amid shouts from the audience that he's saying facts. Speaker after speaker rejected the characterization of the ICE office as merely administrative. Many warned that once ICE establishes a foothold in the city, it rarely withdraws. Not off Pace Greenapple, whose grandfather fled Nazi-occupied Netherlands, referenced relatives murdered in the Sobibor and Treblinka death camps. Quote, "The rise of fascism in our country makes it abundantly clear that we learn as much from history as a rabbit learns from an experiment performed upon it," he said. ICE, our modern-day Gestapo, or slave catchers, are not only here at our doorsteps in Southfield, but have been handed the keys to the house. End quote. He added that the facility would be used by ICE and DHS to produce the legal justification for their attack on our community, serving as a base from which to track, monitor, and surveil us and our neighbors. Fascism is not only ushered in by mass men with guns in the street, he warned. It is supported by the actions of bureaucrats who sign papers, request warrants, and sign legal memoranda. End quote. Another resident said that if ICE entrenched itself in Southfield, the city would begin to resemble a sundown town, recalling her grandparents' experience in Jim Crow, Alabama, and the injunction to carry your ID every day. Others described carrying passports to work out of fear of racial profiling. In a comment to a WSWS reporter, Alexis linked the repression to the economic system itself. Quote, "It's all just about money, so the working class has the upper hand. A general strike would hit where they're going to understand, where the money is." End quote. Crystal Onerva Hinton, a Mexican-American Southfield resident, stated plainly, "What ICE is doing is illegal, and it's fascist." Speaking on behalf of the SCP, Phyllis Steele, a Detroit educator, pointed to the recent ICE kidnapping of 23-year-old Detroit resident Alcides Caceres, the seizure of two Amazon Flex drivers outside a warehouse in Hazel Park, and an ICE operation outside of GM's Factory Zero in the Detroit enclave of Hamtramck. Nearly 250 years since the Declaration of Independence, she said, the convicted criminal in the White House, acting on behalf of a corporate oligarchy, asserted that his power is unlimited. The Democrats issue statements and posture while they fund the same repressive agencies. Quote, "If this is to be stopped, it will be stopped by the mobilization of the working class," Steele said, concluding that auto workers, logistic workers, educators, healthcare workers, you have the power to shut down this machinery of repression. End quote. Cuban workers describe hellish conditions, appeals to U.S. workers to force an end to embargo, by our reporters. The humanitarian situation in Cuba has undergone a catastrophic decline in the 3 weeks following Donald Trump's January 29th executive order declaring the island a national security threat and threatening tariffs on any nation supplying it with oil. Washington has effectively turned its long-standing embargo into an overt attempt to starve the population into submission. While U.S. officials discuss allowing only small quantities of fuel to prevent total infrastructure collapse, the White House demanded last week very dramatic changes in Cuba. The U.S. Supreme Court, moreover, is considering cases demanding Havana pay billions in compensation to U.S. corporations like ExxonMobil for key ports, plantations, and other infrastructure expropriated 6 decades ago. In this dire context, the World Socialist website spoke with Maria, a 32-year-old worker and single mother in Matanzas. Maria is a pseudonym used to protect her identity. Her harrowing testimony exposes the reality of maximum pressure and highlights the necessity of an independent mobilization of the international working class to break the siege. "This place is hell," Maria describes, a reality that exceeds the horror reported in the corporate media. Basic necessities like cooking gas have vanished entirely. Many now rely on increasingly expensive charcoal or even broken furniture for firewood, she explains. While she views Trump's policies as asphyxiating, she also holds the Cuban government responsible for the country's debacle. I'm 32 years old, she continues. I belong to a generation that went to university with enthusiasm and professional ambitions. The Cuban people are tired of being censored, without freedom of expression, afraid to speak freely about the fact that we live in a failed state. The pain is sharpened by the fact that, quote, our friends and colleagues are political prisoners for peacefully disagreeing. The country has been on the road to disaster for years. This didn't start with Trump, although it has worsened under him. Nobody wants to stay here, she says, noting that the sector of society that still trusts in the government is tiny and unrepresentative. Daily life for Maria is a struggle for survival. Electrical outages last between 20 and 30 hours, with power available for only 2 hours or less. The Cuban peso is totally devalued, with one U.S. dollar equaling 500 pesos. Her two jobs as an editor and librarian barely cover the cost of a carton of eggs. Running water is frequently unavailable for days at a time. The black market for imported medicines charges unaffordable prices. Quote, there are hardly any cars on the streets. The country is at a standstill. Inflation is skyrocketing, she explains. This place is hell. For her infant daughter, even watching cartoons has become a, quote, luxury for which she cries daily. And basic items like toys or clothes are, quote, unaffordable for the average citizen. Maria adds that no one has any clear idea how close a full collapse is. Quote, here, no one has any idea how long it will be before everything collapses, she said. We often feel that it is close, but nothing ever happens, although no one remembers things ever being worse than they are now. Children go to sleep hungry. The crisis has manifested in widespread hunger, including among children. Maria confirms that most families cannot afford 3 meals a day and survive on low-quality food with almost no protein. Often a child's only breakfast is an instant soft drink, as even bread has become scarce. This malnutrition is compounded by outbreaks of respiratory and mosquito-borne diseases, which strike a population with weakened immune systems. In schools, meals are often reduced to a single boiled vegetable or a thin broth. Maria notes that a single bag of milk for her daughter costs half of her monthly salary. These accounts are mirrored by some reports on the mainstream media, including workers who describe sleeping in schools to avoid unaffordable transport costs and feeding children soft drinks when milk is unavailable. Information monopoly and a climate of fear. According to Maria, the Cuban government maintains a total monopoly on domestic media, while internet content is often manipulated by various political interests. Cubans are acutely aware that President Díaz-Canel and other officials frequently lie or provide incoherent data. During recent epidemics, the government denied the crisis even as people died in hospitals, choosing to minimize the crisis until the last possible moment. Despite the misery, a palpable climate of fear prevents many from speaking out. Workers contacted by the WSWS reported being interrogated for hours, extorted or threatened with jail for speaking out about social conditions. The role of the American and international working class. When asked about appealing to the American working class rather than the Trump administration, Maria notes that the ideological situation is complex. Decades of indoctrination to remain silent, ideological disorganization, the lack of coherent political leaders, and the primitive survival mode, end quote, have left many Cubans unaware that the American people could offer real support. But the thought that the American working class could mobilize to end the embargo is moving, she added, noting that most Cubans feel they do not matter anymore. Maria expresses interest in the fact that millions in the U.S. have protested against the genocide in Gaza and that workers have the objective power to stop wars by mobilizing independently to stop weapons from reaching Israel. The same power could be used to supply Cuba with fuel, medicine, food, and other vital goods and services, and ultimately to end the blockade entirely. She concludes, "I think it's commendable that the option is on the table. I hope to be of assistance in any way I can, and let's stay in touch." End quote. The first step must be communication, Maria adds, as the information reaching Cuba is heavily biased or controlled by the government. In the United States, workers instinctively recognize the need for solidarity. A New York teacher interviewed by the WSWS stressed that more people need to be informed about the situation in Cuba, though many are currently pulled in different directions by crises in Gaza, Venezuela, and Sudan. She explains, "I feel like the people that want to help are pulled in different directions." End quote. The teacher supports this perspective. Asked about a call to mobilize American workers to end the embargo, she replied, "I will gladly protest and try." That determination must be generalized and organized. The way forward. A planned convoy to Cuba, involving humanitarian organizations and figures like Greta Thunberg, who supported aid flotillas to Gaza, is set to deliver humanitarian aid on March 21st. Such efforts are courageous challenges to imperialist aggression, and the World Socialist website insists that workers internationally must actively defend any such convoy against attempts to block it. However, the limitations of such initiatives to overcome a decades-long embargo by the world's dominant power must be recognized. The continuous provision of food, fuel, and medicine requires the organized intervention of the international working class. Oil, logistics, and transport workers, including dock workers and maritime sailors, must use their control over production and distribution to further the shipment of supplies to Cuba. Port workers must also refuse to load or unload military and other ships enforcing the embargo. Workers across the Americas and Europe must coordinate these actions through rank-and-file committees. The International Workers' Alliance of Rank-and-File Committees provides the framework for this global struggle. Only on this basis can the Cuban working class begin to chart a path out of the nightmare created by the crimes of U.S. imperialism and settle accounts with the island's bourgeois regime. You can find all this and more at the World Socialist website, wsws.org. This has been Archie Stone for the World Socialist website.
The World Socialist website is published by the International Committee of the Fourth International, the ICFI, the leadership of the World Socialist Movement, the Fourth International founded by Leon Trotsky in 1938. The World Socialist website relies entirely on the donations of readers and listeners for financial support. To give to the WSWS or to set up a regular monthly contribution, go to wsws.org/donate. We urge our listeners to join the International Committee of the Fourth International and one of its affiliated political parties and take up the struggle for socialism.